Gladys Clark has agreed to further add to her first oral history tape, and she's going to begin by telling a very interesting story about the moving of Thoreau's cabin.
Well, I'm rather glad that I'm still alive in order to straighten out some of these stories that might have gone down to posterity. I was recently asked by the Thoreau Lyceum to listen to a letter which Anne McGrath had received, and she wanted to read it to me before any publication was made of it. It was a letter, or a story, written by Ina Clark, telling of the day she saw Thoreau's cabin being moved. Ina Clark was my father's cousin. She lived here just at that time, the next house to us. And so I was very happy to hear what she might have said about seeing the cabin moved, because I was well aware that she wasn't living at that time. The story was quite interesting. She said that she was living at her grandfather's house on Esterbrook Road, and it told about coming across to the plain, which is where we live here on Lowell Road, and of visiting with Aunt Suki. That was all very legitimate. Aunt Suki did live here on Lowell Road and was the most interesting individual, as you may have heard from some of the stories. I don't know whether I've told the highlight of Aunt Suki's life or not at some time. Then she told about seeing one day the oxen coming up the road bringing a house, and she called her mother, and her mother said, "Yes, that house is going up the road for a man who isn't very well. He's going to live in that building." Well, after the story was read, I had my grandfather's diary at hand. It was my grandfather who moved the house from the building, as he called it, from Walden Pond to his father's house on Esterbrook Road, which is where Raymond Emerson has been living during his later years. My grandfather's diary said that the house was moved November 3rd, 1849. I had the book right here. And I also had my birthday book, in which Ina Clark had written her name and her birthday, November 13th, 1870. So you see, Ina was not born at the time the house was moved. And she was relying on the stories that she had heard some of the family tell of the moving of the house. And then the question came up, was her mind just a bit weak, and she was just imagining all these things? And I said, Ina Clark's mind was as clear the day she went to Sleepy Hollow as it was the day she wrote her name in my birthday book. But she was just writing a story for children to enjoy. Her sister, Harriet Clark, was a marvelous teacher of the lower grades, and perhaps Ina was writing the story for her children, because in those days, children were read stories, and I just thought, well, she's just following in the footsteps of Louisa Alcott, and writing an enjoyable story for the children. So when everything was said and done, I thought, well, I'm glad I'm living today so that posterity will have the truth about that story, that Ina Clark was just having just a little fun story to amuse or to interest other children.
Well, I think that's the importance of primary sources.
Oh, yes. Well, when we're speaking about Esterbrook Road, of course my great, 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 well, how many greats? Grandfather, Benjamin Clark, the first Benjamin Clark to be here in Concord, built that house on Esterbrook Road, and it remained in the family until, I can't tell exactly what year, but it went from one Benjamin Clark to another Benjamin Clark, and to another Benjamin Clark, and finally to Daniel Clark, who was the youngest of Benjamin Clark Jr. And Benjamin Clark Jr. was the one who went down to the bridge and also served in Cambridge during the Revolution. And so Daniel was his youngest son, and he stayed there and cared for the family. I understand he was a very thrifty person, and from what I have seen in the home over there, I knew that whatever he had, he bought very judiciously. And although it was a plain country home, there were very nice pieces of furniture, some of which I have here in this house. And it was interesting to know that he really lived very well. Then he, as a bachelor, passed the property on to a nephew of his, Cyrus Clark. Cyrus Clark was a well-known character in my day. He, too, was a bachelor, really, but he had married briefly, and his wife had passed away. But we always thought of him as being a bachelor. And he was quite well known in town for being quite avaricious. And my father once said to him, "Well, Cyrus, why don't you spend your money and have a good time?" And I thought his reply was very well put. "Well, if whoever gets it enjoys spending it as much as I have saving it, it's all right with me." Cyrus lived to be well along in his 90s. I think he was 96. And in his last illness, he wouldn't take a pill. No, he was going to get well without any medicine. But Cyrus finally had to succumb. He always wore a white shirt. It was white as long as he kept out from away from the barn. But he had an affinity for the barn, and cows were his real love. So the shirt wasn't very white for the end of the day. He also was quite a character around here, because He believed in the laying on of hands to cure everything. And one day he was here at my house, and my mother had a headache or something, and he wanted to lay on his hands, and my mother said, "Oh, that would make her worse than ever." But however, we always enjoyed him because we could hear his voice way across the fields as he calling to his horse when he would be out mowing hay or anything, "Come on, Kate, come on, Kate." And the horse was as much of it as the real part of his life. So Cyrus is quite an interesting character. Then the property went to his niece, Mariella Tabble, who was a sweet little lady, and then Raymond Nevison finally became the last purchaser of the family. And I might say at this time that when the covenant of the Unitarian Church was drawn up, Benjamin Clark and Thomas Esterbrook were the first signers of that covenant, they were the only residents of Esterbrook Road. Now, perhaps I should tell you a bit about things on what is now called Hugh Cargill Road. To us, it was always the lane. In the days around 1850 or so, my grandfather had land up the lane, as we called it, on the hill, which is now where there are houses now, of course, all over there. He planted great vineyards, and great apple and pear orchards. He He experimented with many different types of pears and apples. In one place of his diary, he tells about planting 500 apple trees and 200 or 300 peach trees. I don't know just where all those are planted, but he planted them all over the area which we now call the lane, and way up the lane, or now Hugh-Carter Road, and off Hugh-Carter Road, there is an area called a peach orchard, and I suppose that must be where he planted his peach trees. He also planted them along Lowell Road on the property which was adjacent to his land on Lowell Road. He had bought the Jacob Farmer farm in his later years, and that was where he did a great deal of experimenting with strawberries and asparagus. In fact, I believe he introduced those two crops to Concord, and he sold his first strawberries to the Colonial Inn for 50 cents a box, which was quite a tremendous price in those days. The trees which he planted along Lowell Road, adjacent to his property and on his property, were of all varieties, and I can remember as a child waiting for the school barge, as we called it then, and eating some of those apples which he had where he had planted the trees. And one tree is left, and that is a very strong, straggly thing, joining on William Wyman's property. He wanted to cut it down, but Mrs. Wyman said, "That's a historical tree. You're going to let it stay there." So just how long nature's going to let it stay, I don't know. But that is the last of the trees which he planted in probably the late 1850s and very early 1860s.
So Farmer's Cliff Road is named after?
Farmer's Cliff Road is named after Jacob Farmer, whose farm he had bought. When my brother took over our family farm here on the opposite side of Lowell Road and decided that he could no longer continue farming here and sold the land into house lots, he called the street which he put in he named it after Jacob Farmer, called it Farmer's Cliff Road, because if you go to the end of Farmer's Cliff Road and look very carefully upward, you will see a cliff, and that was called Farmer's Cliff. Just why it should be called Farmer's Cliff, I don't know, because as far as I know, that property belonged to Rufus Clark, and Rufus Clark bought the he inherited from his father, Joe Clark, and I understand the place is called, the house is called Hugh Cargill House, but as far as Hugh Cargill may have built that house, but he certainly didn't live there very long, because Joe Clark, I can't tell you the date that Joe Clark went there without looking it up to be accurate, but anyway, three generations of Clarks lived there up through my up through the 1920s, and so I think that Hugh Cargill may have owned land up the lane, which is now called Hugh Cargill Road, but it would have been, of course, many, many years ago, because it had belonged to the Joe Clark, Rufus Clark, and Hattie Clark family down until my father, well, my cousin had it, in settling the estate. But on that property, which is that I've just spoken of, where my grandfather had, well, now my grandfather owned that too, come to think of it. Well, I think people used to swap land back and forth, as near as I can make out. Half of the land up the lane there has been, first Joe would have it, and then John would have it, and then George would have it. And so you really can't pin down the way they were swapping things around. So when my grandfather had that property, that's when he put in the vineyard and the apple trees and the pear trees of various sorts. And there also was a soap factory up there. Now, just where in the time the soap factory came in, I don't know. But as a child, I can remember seeing sort of a wall, stones built up, and then there were big kettles, two great big iron kettles. And I suppose those were the kettles in which the fat was tried out, I guess they called it. And of course there was a little, tiny little man-made pond there, right at the area where the soap factory used to be. I don't know anything beyond the fact that there was a factory there. It could have been of long duration. I saw the ruins of it, and I've seen the great big huge iron kettles that were used. And the Tompkins used to have one with flowers in their yard, and I'm not sure, but that one of those kettles is still around here somewhere. But that's something in history that has never been recorded, and people just knew about it and forgot it, and that was it. Well, so that's a bit of the history of Hugh Cargill Road. And now I might speak about the houses on Lowell Road, because so many of them have disappeared. All of the houses were built four square. There were no cottage houses. They were all four square, all right next to the road and facing south. And now we can count very few that are still in existence. Most of them were burned. People were very careless with their fireplaces and with the ashes. But if I start back at the Carlisle line, I can see where the Howes now live. There was a lovely old square house there that was burned within my memory. And then there was one where the, let's see, that was a Melvin house where, I can't think of the name of the people who lived there. But anyway, all along Lower Road, there were these lovely old square houses. And the families were mostly Melvins and Davis, and they intermarried one with the other. I was just saying that the people on Lowell Road seemed to intermarry, the Davises and the Melvins and the Dakins. We had the Dakins here. And then the people on Estabrook Road with my family, Clark family, they married onto Monument Street, the Flints and the Balls. So there seemed to be areas in which the people intermarried. And then if you take the area around Nine Acre Corner, the Wheelers and the Parmenters and the Rices, they all married the Sudbury and Lincoln and Concord people. But there were no Wheelers who were marrying people on Lowell Road, no Rices or Parmenters marrying people on Lowell Road. Each area was seemed to be separate. And then, of course, the people on Barrett's Mill Road intermarried with the people on Lowell Road. Barrett's Mill Road and Lowell Road were very closely related. And speaking of marrying and intermarrying, I can remember my father asking a certain man who was really quite on the ball, "How did you happen to marry your wife?" He said, "She was the last one there was." So they just chose what was around, and he waited too long.
Well, thank you.
About 1890, it was rather customary for a number of people from Concord to go to California. Alonzo Tower was quite interested in the project, and he arranged to have a car sidetracked at the Concord Railroad Station each fall for a number of years, and organized a group to take off to spend the winter in California. It happened that several people stayed and made permanent homes there. Concord, California was one of the towns that was settled by people from Concord, Mass. And I had a letter from someone in Pasadena when a church was being remodeled there, and they wanted to know, they had traced the source of their bell that was given to them as far as Concord, when it was given by Fred Tower, and they wanted to know something about him. And so he had left his mark there with somebody from Worcester, Fred Tower, and someone whose name I can't recall from Worcester, had donated the bell to the church, and their names were inscribed and their place of birth on that. And also when in California, I met a friend of the Smith family, I believe his name was Charlie Smith, who had gone there to make his home in, now I can't recall the name of the place, but it was down near Santa Barbara. And so all up and down the coast of California, we'll find descendants of some of our Concord people who started off, who went out to spend the winter. Now, among those people who went and returned was Cyrus Clark, who was really a Concord character from this end of town. And this morning, he was downtown delivering a load of wood. And someone said, "Why, Cyrus, I thought you were going to California." And he said, "Train doesn't go to noon." He was going to get his money's worth in by delivering a load of wood before he took off for California. Well, so there are many little interesting anecdotes about what happened to those people. And I know one family who went, when I met a descendant of theirs, I found that they were as typical as their people back here in Concord. Very elite, wearing, meeting me with a horse and carriage, and wearing a very lovely horse, by the way, and wearing kid gloves to drive the horse. And I thought, oh, just a little bit of the breeding of Concord is still here in California.
That's and a lovely story.
Then, too, there's the town of Healdsburg, just above San Francisco, and I think that must have been settled by people, the Heald family from Carlisle, because, again, our New Englanders were the people who settled in California, especially toward the north, and that's why we find these Victorian houses all through California. Of course, some of them begin as far south as Los Angeles, but San Francisco and that area north are predominantly Victorian, because that country was being settled at the time of the Victorian era and by people here from the Middle East, and Concord did her part in settling there.
Thank you.